spots to see if there would be a change. Of course, Freon's out now, but, you know, they make other stuff now, you know, 134 or something. Okay, we'll look into it, boy. You know, it's a great little radio. You know, like I said, you get the ham station, you can get CW. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. You know, if you ever find out anything about it, let us know. But, you know, thermal tolerances are a factor in circuit design. One of the many reasons why NASA equipment tends to be more expensive, there's a load of reasons, but one of them is the wide swings in temperature that it has to operate within specs. And just because it does that when it comes off of the factory doesn't mean, you know, years and years later that it will be nice and stable. So, yeah, I would think it's just an indication that there's a component that's going into failure. It might stick around and stay the way it is right now, or it might progressively get worse over time and suffer with less temperature fluctuations than it presently does. But I hope it doesn't. I hope it works for you well, and or you figure out exactly what's going wrong with it.
Okay, yeah, I figured, well, it's basically a knockoff from the Sony 2010, which was a real super-duper radio, I'm telling you. But the Elmer that I knew lent me that thing probably for a year, you know, just to listen to CW and practice. That was a great radio. And when I saw this, I said, this looks like a duplicate of that. I wound up buying it many years ago. Maybe just get tired. It's old. Okay, back to you, Roy.
Yeah, yeah. My guess, purely a guess, is that it's not a rebranded Sony, because Sony, I don't know if they really were into rebranding. They really loved the markup that their name could supply. My guess would tend to be that it was probably more likely a Chinese clone, that they just took a couple of radios back into the factory and reverse engineered them as they're prone to, and just pumped out a lot of clones for a significantly lower price.
Oh yeah, and it was a big difference. The Sonys, oh, I remember when they came out, probably mid-80s, that was going for like, I don't know, $399 when they first started coming out. Even back then, it was really high. And this thing, you know, was a Radio Shack. Compared to that, they were giving it away, you know. I don't think I paid, I know I paid less than $100. Okay, very good. Back to you, Roy.
It's AF2P.
Yeah, 2P.
And the thing is old enough where the electrolytes are always suspect just due to age. Sounds like the PLL is coming unlocked. And yeah, that happens with age components and with heat, so you probably can fix it, like Roy said, with the cold spray. You can find what's failing. But you have to take it apart, which can be half the battle, and you have to inspect it to see that there's no liquid from the electrolytics. That's what I got. Back to you. Back to Roy.
I could do that. Very good. Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. And it even says PLL on it, phase lock loop. It actually has PLL written on that radio. Roy, over to you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ed, AF2P. And I hope you find out what's doing with that and fix it. And yeah, electrolytic capacitors are the bane of all of our lives. There was a time, unfortunately, when motherboards were being built with second or third rate electrolytic capacitors, and they weren't lasting a year. But you know, they're kind of the weakest link of our electronic devices to this day. It's a shame. You'd think that people would come up with a more bulletproof solution, but they build them nicer, tighter, cleaner, but, you know, they still can fail, unfortunately.
A2SCP.
Yes, Ed.
I think that's Chris, Roy.
Oh, sorry, Chris. What can I do you for?
Hey, guys. Yeah, it's Chris, K2SCP. I'm on a handheld. Hopefully I'm making it. Paul, that scanner is likely made by GRE, so Gamma Radio Echo. They made most of the Lafayette and Radio Shack scanners back in the day, if I'm not mistaken. They also had a logic controller on a little tiny logic controller chip they used to use, and those were very sensitive to heat back in the day. And that, I would guess, is the problem. The logic controller is telling it to change frequencies or bands or whatever it's doing. And I would take a look at that. And taking those apart, there's not a whole lot in those. I know the 2010 pretty well. There's not much in there.
Okay, let me see if I got it. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I haven't opened it yet. I mean, this has only creeped up in the last couple of days, so I'll give it a shot, Chris. What did you think of the 2010?
Those were good from what I remember. I never owned one, but I knew a fellow that had one, and he loved it, so he was pretty technical, so I would guess they were good receivers, but I never had it myself, but it, you know, I remember being there and listening to it. Worked pretty well. K2SCP.
I still see them on eBay every once in a while. Very good. Thanks, Chris. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net. We're here to hopefully help you with your amateur radio technical questions and problems and situations. So if you have any of those, please hit the push-to-talk button and tell us your first name and your call sign. Okay, I just got a little fraction of that transmission, so if you want to try again.
WB2BXO, Frank, via Echo Link. How you doing, Roy?
I'm doing fine, Frank. I heard you're great this time. What can I do for you tonight?
Okay, it was a nice 6-meter opening to the Caribbean late this morning. I worked using a remote site across the sound in Connecticut. I worked Barbados and Guadalupe and was trying to figure out the propagation mode. Doesn't seem like conditions are good enough for it to be F-layer. Might be E-skip. I wonder if anybody's been monitoring and has any thoughts on that. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, I'd be interested to know if anyone noticed any of that. I was on 10 meters this morning, as I generally am on Sunday mornings, because I have a 10-meter net to keep 10 meters alive, and there was absolutely no propagation going on 10 meters during 11 to about 12:45. The farthest I was able to talk to people were in Staten Island. There's no opening. But if anyone out there passed by 6 meters and has any ideas of what might have been going on, please hit that push to talk.
Yeah, well, that was FT8. I mean, signals were weak, but they were there.
Okay, you got to keep in mind that things like FT8 kind of defy the usual understanding of how things work. Last Sunday night, just for the heck of it, while I was doing the technical net, I was using Joe Taylor's Whisper to receive signals on 10 meters, and I kept on getting pinged by a guy in Australia. So you know, and I don't think 10 meters was that strong last Sunday night. But so yeah, when you factor in the low signal aspects of FT8 and all the other of Joe Taylor's, previous understanding of propagation conditions sometimes don't really hang together as well.
M2KW.
Yes, Alan.
Just around this time of year, just around the time of the ARRL VHF QSO party, June 1st, the FAA had a 1.8 kW transmitter, I think, at JFK, and they had, they're up on 136 megs, and they had a regular path to Bermuda. Starting this time of year for months. So you got to wonder about Tropo as well. I didn't hear the opening, but you got to wonder about Tropo just because of the time of year. Over.
Okay, yeah, I mean, we've seen tropospheric ducting before where all of a sudden repeaters across the East Coast come in way too loud for us. You know, people who hear repeaters from Boston, others hear repeaters from Pennsylvania. So it certainly is a thing.
Yeah. The ultimate of that was when Dave Hubby, W2SNM, got an SWL report from Charlie Tango 3 Bravo Bravo, who heard the 147.36 repeater in Azores. Over.
Oh, very good. And that was before Joe Taylor's low signal algorithms.
Yep. Hey, I've had a terrific adventure on 2 meters I'd like to share.
Okay, Frank, any other points to be made on the subject?
I'm not sure that Tropo is a big player on 6 meters. I know it is a big player on 2 meters, and I'm not surprised at that on 136. The FAA site, it's a big player. I don't know if it's supposedly it does work as low as 10 meters, but anyway, that's interesting. I guess it's a possibility. I'm guessing this was sporadic E, though. And yeah, Alan, I do remember when that report came in back in the 70s from Charlie Tango 2, Bravo Bravo. I didn't remember the guy's call in the Azores. But FM, considering the amount of dB loss you have on FM over CW or FT8 or any weak signal mode, that is that was kind of incredible. I'm sorry, I might have been covering the microphone here. Anyway, yeah, I do remember when that report came in. But just in case you weren't hearing me just now, because I think it was covering the microphone, I'm not sure that Chopo is a big player on 6 meters, though I realize it is on the higher frequencies. Go ahead, guys.
Okay, very good, Frank. Thank you. Alan, you wanted to tell us something?
Okay, I want to tell you about my 2 meter adventures. I will say that I've taken advantage of Tropo during low sunspot years in the ARRL 10 meter contest. So I know it's got to be a factor on 6 if I took advantage of it on 10. And they do meter scatter on 10, too. And whatever, that's a whole other subject. I want to talk about 2 meters. So I got this Baofeng UV-5, you know, the most common one. And first I thought I'd just put it in the console with the rubber duck antenna and monitor 5.2. And put a bumper sticker on that I was monitoring 5.2 and figured that anybody could read the bumper sticker and have no problem hearing them. But then I put an NMO antenna on top of the car, dual band, and, you know, I've been on UHF, and I've had several adventures. First thing I did was I bought a Larson 5/8 wave antenna because I've had good luck with that in the past. Except the setup that I bought resonates above 148. Let me let it drop. So I know how to fix that. Larson sells a spring, and I'll buy the spring and cut the antenna shorter, but I feel cheated because the whip had never been cut. This is original, you know, and it's just too short. Tough nookie. So, then I bought a, I'm looking for the label here. I bought an extended antenna to replace the rubber duck that has more gain, a Nagoya, Nagoya what? NA771. But I bought it from a mail order outfit in China. And it's bootlegged. The rubber duck works better than the bootleg Nagoya. Let me let it drop. Not learning my lesson. I bought a Nagoya antenna that's supposed to handle 150 watts, NL770S, from the same site. And this one, the SWR, is beautiful from the right in the middle of the center. But once again, it doesn't hear as well as the rubber ducky does. Lastly, and this is really funny, I bought a battery eliminator for the UV-5 so I could plug into the cigarette lighter and never have to worry about the battery running down. And, you know, it would come on when I turned on the car. Everything was great except it blew the fuse. So it's a new antenna installation. It's a new handy-talkie, and it's a new power supply. I consider that three suspect areas, and one of them is responsible for the fuse blowing. Let me let it drop. I went back to the rubber duck antenna with the handy-talkie under the seat, so I wasn't using the rooftop antenna, and the fuse blew, so I knew the antenna had nothing to do with it. I then took the battery eliminator off of the handy-talkie, but left it plugged in, figuring if the fuse blew this time, it had to be the battery eliminator, and sure enough, the fuse blew. But now I'm thinking, I'll let it drop, and the last one will be my final. My friend Rob, who does a lot of audio-visual work, saw that I have my iPhone plugged into my cigarette lighter, and he cautioned me that's not a good idea that he's seen too many iPhones blow out like that, and he suspects aftermarket chargers or whatever. I did a little poking around, and I found out, yeah, you can blow your iPhone like that, but it's not the aftermarket charger. When you start your car, there's a big transient spike, and that's what blows the iPhone. He says, you'd be just fine if you left it unplugged until the car was running, and then you plugged it in. And I suspect that that is why my fuse is blowing on the battery eliminator for the Baofeng HT. I think it's because I have it plugged in. This is N2KW, over.
Okay, that might be what's going on. I would imagine it would be possible to build surge protection into these components, but it would add additional cost. And this seller probably is giving you his least expensive products. I don't know. I mean, you know, you kind of play Russian roulette with Chinese clones. Sometimes they're built in the same factory as the original products, and so they're okay. But other times they're complete garbage. So, you know, there were times where you couldn't even depend upon connectors to be right. The thread dimensions were just ever so slightly off on some batches. So, yeah, it could be that, but you can probably engineer around something like that. But with the price margins of these manufacturers and sellers, you're probably not going to see anything like that in their designs.
Ed, AF2P.
Yes, Ed.
Your mention of Chinese stuff, oh my. I bought a meter called a Mustool, M-U-S-T-O-O-L, a DMM, years ago. It arrived broken. I eventually fixed it. And I'm still running the original batteries. The original batteries are double A's. Well, guess what? Those double A's are just a hair skinnier than regular double A's. I mean, you can't see it. But when you go to put in, like, a Duracell or Energizer or whatever, they won't fit. The regular double A you buy down at Home Depot or whatever, it will not fit. And it's just, I mean, it's really, really, maybe a millimeter. It's just a small difference in diameter. A Chinese battery, I couldn't believe it. Right.
Say again, there was a lot of all kinds of strange signals going on simultaneously to whoever was transmitting.
I say again, go to Harbor Freight. Get the Thunder batteries.
Okay, did you hear that, Ed?
Yes, sir, I sure did. I will try those Thunder batteries over there and see if they fit.
Yeah, I mean, I've experienced Chinese devices where the batteries are not the standard size. They're ever so slightly off. And you know, Chinese products range all over the place. Of course, our beloved iPhones are manufactured in China, but there's a lot of quality assurance going on, a lot of people watching each other. There's this great word in Chinese, I think, and I'm sure I'm going to completely massacre it, something along the lines of chabao, which sort of means do it as half-assed as you could possibly get away with. So, you know, left to individual workers, unfortunately, pride in manufacturer is not a universal concept. So you could you know, it's kind of dangerous to just kind of randomly take your chances with Chinese goods. It's always good to use some intermediary that kind of shields you from just plain garbage, like Amazon, where you know you contact them and they take it back or they just refund you. I've bought more than a few things from China through Amazon where basically eventually after 2 months they send me the wrong item. And they're very nice about it. They say, okay, we'll refund you. Don't write anything nasty about us. And, you know, we part company. But you got to be very, 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 very cautious. If you feel lucky, you know, if you think you're Clint Eastwood and you feel lucky, then sure. You just go on Alibaba and then buy something from a Chinese manufacturer. But there's always that chance that it's going to be complete garbage.
Yes, I see.
Yeah, good chance.
Well, you'll never know. You never know. I mean, I've bought stuff that comes from China that works. I've bought from China things that don't work, and then I return them or get a refund. But, you know, you got to be very wary, and it depends upon you. You end up paying additional for that backup from, say, Amazon or a legitimate company that stands behind their stuff. But I think it's worth it. I'm not that much of a gambler. Chris, K2STP, I think you wanted to say something?
Pardon the interruption, but can I get a radio check, please?
Okay. You're about 10% noise, but otherwise quite readable.
Oh, boy. This is N2KW with a good Amazon story.
Okay. You know, I mean, I'm a big fan of Amazon because I don't have to work there. I don't think that would be a fun job, but it certainly is a very useful thing that I've taken advantage of for many years. So please feel free, Alan.
Okay. I needed a particular fluorescent green lacquer that's made by Rust-Oleum. It's an automotive color, and you can find it on the Home Depot website. Six cans are $36, but the store doesn't stock it. You have to order it and then pick it up a week later at the store. Six cans, $36. It wasn't enough. I needed more. I didn't want to wait another week, and I found out that AutoZone has it. I was so glad, and they had my color, too. And I was a little annoyed at paying $13 a can. I was a little annoyed at paying more than twice as much. But I really needed it. It was only two cans. And, you know, that's the way it goes. But then I started thinking, what if I could find it on online, even cheaper? So I checked on Amazon. $18. Same product, same manufacturer, same color. You could pay $6, $13, or $18. Caveat emptor.
Well, I mean, that's always good advice. Amazon is an easy place to find and look for things. You know, there are some sites where searching for a product, you could waste a day and it could be there, but you'll never find it. But, you know, like all things, and a lot of times it's not them directly selling it. They're reselling it, or they're just acting as the intermediary. And I've seen semi-ridiculous prices for things. In my cases, they weren't really commercial items. I have Forbidden Planet is one of my favorite movies, and so I have the robot from Forbidden Planet. And I think it came from Japan. And it's in very small supply, and it's very, very rare that it's available. And I bought one, and it's nice. I got it. I'm looking at it right now. But I was curious whether it was still available, and I looked it up, and some reseller, I think from Japan, had the nerve to be charging hundreds and hundreds of dollars for it. Now, I'm reasonably sure no one actually bought it for that amount of money, but occasionally you will find items on Amazon that have a ridiculous price simply because their reseller decided to try and make a ridiculous profit off of it.
Obviously, you've never heard of the greater fool theory.
No, actually, we discussed the greater fool theory about 4 or 5 months ago when we talked about cryptocurrency.
Perfect.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to fall down into that subject, but there are people who are making a lot of money off of cryptocurrency and non-fungible tokens, not only the thieves and scoundrels who are setting things up, but occasionally lucky guys out there who find a less lucky fool after them. So that's what drives a lot of these things, not just the crooks, but the guys on the outskirts who are promoting all of this and profiting themselves. So yeah, the last fool is a very important philosophy in just about any economic model.
Well, hey, let me tell you about a really, really great product that comes from China. And you can buy it on Alibaba, or you can buy it on Wish, or you can buy it on Amazon, if you like. It costs a little more on Amazon. I think Alibaba has the cheapest price. It's a telegraph gate, and the key word is stainless steel. It's about $40, and it's as good as Bengali. Stainless steel telegraph gate. Over.
Okay, I'll have to look that up because Bengalis are lovely keys. I don't own any of them. I have some. I have a Kent. I have two Kents. I have an English key that looks quite beautiful. It's chromed up and has gold accent tones on it. But I never could rationalize spending the money for a Bengali, but I'll take a look. I don't know, stainless steel versus chrome plating. I'll take a look at least. You know, it doesn't cost me anything to do that.
No. It's not a question of stainless steel versus chrome plating. This is a $40 key. It's as good as a $400 key. It's an incredible value. It should be $99, but I hope the manufacturer never learns that. Everybody keeps the manufacturer's name secret. I used to have it, and I lost it. I don't have the model number. That's kept a secret. The only way you find it is if you search for stainless steel telegraph key. And it's not a straight key. It's an iambic paddle.
Okay, I'll take a look, and I'm sure that you own a J38 as well.
Oh, I've probably got a dozen keys. Yes, I have a J38, and I have check straight keys, and I have Wartronic paddles and Viperplex paddles and Les Logan bugs and stuff that doesn't have a name on it, but I'm telling you, this is right up with the very best. Over.
Okay, I'll do a little Google searching when the TechNet is over and see what's there. To me it's more, you know, just of a play thing. I have a Morse code key on my desk right now. I don't have the patience to learn to read speed fast enough to be interested in you know, trying it out on the air. I can send reasonably well. I don't think it's that much of a problem to send, especially on iambics. It's receiving it that, you know, requires you to actually put in a little time.
Well, I disagree completely. So I guess you just don't spend enough time receiving or you're afraid or something, but I'm a good CW operator. I can receive a lot faster than I can send, and I can send a lot faster than you can receive. Over.
Well, I'm sure of the latter. I mean, the problem is I'm easily distracted, so you got to apply yourself in small bits repeatedly throughout the days, weeks, months. You can't just kind of barrel into it for a week or two and then move on to something else and then come back to it a month later. And unfortunately, that tends to be how I attack things. And so, my motivation isn't that strong for it. One of the reasons why I finally went and got a license was because I had discovered that they no longer had the Morse code requirements. Made my life much easier.
We won't talk about no code at all, but I'll tell you that when I was a little boy, we had almost no books in the house. One of the books we had was the Blue Jackets Manual, which is the Navy Bible. And I read it cover to cover many times, and I learned knots and seamanship and survival. Oh, yeah, I memorized the Morse code. And I told my father that I memorized Morse code. He says, oh, yeah, I know Morse code. And I said, I didn't know you were a radio operator. And he says, I wasn't. He says, when the fleet was at anchor, we had to communicate by heliograph. I was the helio operator. So we used to dim the lights in the living room and blink jokes at each other. And my mother would come in and start yelling because she felt left out. Hold on, let me let it drop. So while I can thank my father for helping me practice my Morse, I should really thank my mother for helping me to learn to copy through QRM, because that's my specialty. Over.
Okay, very good. That's a good story. I tried to learn Morse code in high school. I didn't know any hams. I didn't know anyone who really knew Morse code. I found some guy in my class that had a curiosity towards it. He had no interest in amateur radio. For some odd reason, it was just Morse code. And we spent far too much time tapping out insults and obscenities on the gym locker to each other, such that to this day, if I just sit there with a Morse code key and absentmindedly move it around, it probably would be an FCC violation.
Yeah, well, how do you think W2 Fox Uniform picked this call?
Okay, but you can get away with that. But what we were tapping out to each other on the gym lockers would be a undeniable violation of FCC laws.
Okay. Well, I learned it. Dots and dashes on the page, then blinking lights with my dad, then with a single flag when I was in the Boy Scouts. And I joined the radio club in high school because I wanted to learn about radios. I was so disappointed to find out that it was a ham radio club. And they wouldn't teach me any theory until I learned Morse code. And I said, ha ha, I know Morse code.
I had the opposite problem. I was perpetually looking for amateur radio operators, and I heard there was a local explorer club that was going to be teaching people how to be amateur radio operators, so I joined. And then I found out, unfortunately, that there wasn't a single amateur radio operator anywhere around that organization. At best, there was one or two CB operators.
You missed Kilo 2 Bravo Sugar. Shelly was around forever. And good operator and a good scout.
I just didn't know these people. I wasn't even a member of the Boy Scouts or Explorers. Someone mentioned an Explorer group that was forming within walking distance to where I lived as a kid. So I said, yeah, what the hell? The only thing I probably would have benefited from staying home and watched Genie. It was something about a genie living with an astronaut or something. But learned nothing. They taught schematics. I already knew schematics. I think that's where they just kind of ran out of steam. So I tried a few times during my high school years, but I just couldn't for the life of me find any actual hams interested in helping. So I retired it and went on to my professional career.
Hey, might dream a genie.
Yes, indeed. That was the name of the great television show, I Dream of Jeannie. They don't make shows like that anymore. I won't say if that's a positive or a negative, but they don't. Anyway, it's been lovely chatting, Alan. I hope you'll stick around and come back. Wesley, you wanted to ask a science-related question or a topic tonight?
Yeah, and to expand. We spoke about magnets, but it was short and before the space report. And, of course, you can have different set of questions. Dr. Roy or B ask different set of questions. So I would like to keep it entertaining and quite challenging to some people, because even if something looks obvious, it doesn't mean that we know the answer. We may just take it as given. Let me drop. So we have a magnet, and we may ask plenty of questions. Why is that at low temperature the magnet is suspended, kind of frozen? But that would be the end of the discussion, I believe, and we may ask for a simple questions. We try to specify what is work and what is force. That's energy from magnet to the work. So, Dr. Roy, I mean, does somebody else want to participate and to agree?
AC2GS, well, let's take it from the beginning. Work is not force. If work was force, among other things, they would have the same units. Force is newtons. Work is newton meters. Work is the application of force across doing something to move something in mechanical work, and there's other types of work. So just because an object produces a force does not mean it's doing work, because if that was possible, and again, it's not, a lot of things would make far less sense. Now, you know, if you take some heavy object and you put it on the ground, that object has a force to the ground. If that meant that work was being done, that would mean that energy was being expended. That would mean, according to the laws of conservation of energy, that you're losing something. And so the problem would be, well, where are you gaining it so that it equals zero? And the answer is nowhere, because there's no energy transfer in an object sitting on your floor. But there is a force that can be measured that the object is applying to the center of gravity of the Earth. So that's a case where force is not the same as work or energy. So you can't kind of say that. When people use a magnet to produce energy, they are not using the energy of the magnetic domains. They are using the magnet as a transducer. They are moving the magnet's magnetic field, and the kinetic energy of that movement is being translated into an electrical potential in the case of a simple crank generator. So it does not use up the magnetic field in the battery, because you are not extracting that energy. You are simply using it to convert kinetic energy to electromotive force.
Establish that the force is a vector and has both the direction and the magnitude. And we also establish that work is the energy transferred to or from the object via the application of force around the displacement. The question is, then, does the magnet do the work? And to exceed?
No, the magnet doesn't do the work. The movement of the magnet is the work.
Okay. So we're dealing with very much ignorant body that doesn't care about anything and everything, that doesn't like you or doesn't have a feeling of liking or disliking. It's just something that doesn't even say, don't touch me. It's just, I don't cooperate and I will never cooperate. Yes, you can move me. Yes, you can do tricks with me, but I'm not there. I mean, I'm there, but it's just because of what you're doing with me. But myself, I do nothing. Do you agree with that?
I'm not quite sure what you're setting up here. The universe is indifferent to all of us. It just does what it does. It doesn't apply a value judgment. It's not lazy. It doesn't lie. It doesn't steal. It just is, and it just does. So I'm always have a problem when people try to anthropomorphize laws of nature. So I'm not quite sure what you're getting at here, but it sounds sort of like you're anthropomorphizing laws of nature.
What I'm trying to say is that magnet is not cooperating. It is us doing something with magnets and using the properties of the magnets. But magnet by itself doesn't change or doesn't participate by itself. No, it's not the proper. Yeah, it doesn't participate. And to achieve. Easy to be all clear.
Yes, Jeff.
Oh, I'm just clearing and thanking you for holding the net.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. 73, have a good week. I hope you come back next week.
Yeah, I hope to as well.
Okay, getting back, Wes, I don't really understand. Again, you're anthropomorphizing a magnet. Magnets are indifferent. Bowls of rice are indifferent. Just about everything in the universe is pretty much indifferent. They really don't hold opinions or attitudes. You know, I've never kind of come across a rock with a bad attitude.
Thank you for helping me with English rephrasing. That's exactly what I was trying to say. Okay. We could specify somehow energy of the magnet. I assume that we could point at two types of energy from the magnet. Would you say something about it?
Okay. There is an inherent energy in the utilized in orienting the magnetic dipole moments of a permanent magnet in alignment. Permanent magnets don't come out of the foundry as permanent magnets. They come out as alloys of grains of material that have internal magnetic dipole moments that are randomly oriented. Then you apply a very strong external magnetic field and align the internal magnetic moments. So there's a degree of order established out of disorder, and there's an amount of energy required to do those alignments. And that's the basis for hysteresis loops losses in things like transformers. If you use a material for a transformer that's ferrimagnetic as opposed to ferromagnetic, they hold on, they're less sticky to alignment of magnetic poles, and so there's less energy loss shifting their magnetic fields back and forth. So you have less hysteresis loss for objects that don't strongly hold on to their alignment. So that alignment is a form of energy, and if you could extract the energy from the alignment, after which the magnet would no longer be magnetic, that's a possibility. That's the only type of energy that I can think of that, say, permanent magnets have that other objects don't.
Roy, WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
I'm listening to Wesley's signal. It's kind of like a ringing noise, loud ringing noise. I don't know if he's overdriving or, unless it's my rig, so I'm just checking with you. Do you hear that? Back to you, Horace.
I hear the same thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one of it, I think he's talking a little bit too close to the microphone, possibly. Can you try a couple inches away and try again?
I say, unfortunately, I have a condition that is very loud.
Okay, maybe that's what's going on, is the background noise giving an artifact to it.
Okay, I have switched off right now the compressor. Is it better now?
Yes, it's better now.
Thank you very much. So, because the magnetic field is generated by electron currents, the magnetic energy is an energy from the moving charge carrier's electrons. Is that correct?
Well, but in that case, you're not talking about a permanent magnet. You're simply talking about an induced magnetic field due to current. That's not the same as a permanent magnet because, as we all know, you could turn the current off and the permanent magnet is still going to have a magnetic field.
At the atomic level, at quantum physics, we have unpaired electrons that are responsible for the magnetic field. Is that true?
Yes, unopposed electron spin is what's causing objects to have magnetic dipole moments that can be aligned.
Okay. So, when I was talking about magnetic fields generated by electric current, I was improperly formulating the I was trying to describe what kind of energy does the magnet have. So each magnetic field contains energy, also called magnetic energy, and because the magnetic field is generated by electric currents, the magnetic energy is an energy from moving charge carriers, electrons. So electrons, but I screw up the entire sentence and direction.
Yeah, well, again, you have to differentiate the type of magnet, and there are way too many magnets. There's our good friend ferromagnetism, but there's also ferrimagnetism. There's also paramagnetism. There's also diamagnetism. There's also antimagnetism. So there's a lot of different things under the broad term of magnets. A current will induce a magnetic field without any kind. It doesn't have to be magnetic material. Copper is diamagnetic. It repels magnets. But still, if you put a charge through it, the current will induce a magnetic field. So there's a difference between an electromagnet and a permanent magnet.
Okay. So does the magnet lose magnetism in time, and why?
Yes, a permanent magnet over time will tend to lose its magnetism because over time, thermal effects will jiggle the magnetic dipole moments of each grain and randomize them. If you get the permanent magnet up to a certain temperature called a Curie point, it is enough average kinetic energy for the magnetic dipole moments to completely randomize, and the permanent magnet loses its magnetism entirely. If you keep it below the Curie point, it will maintain its magnetism, but over the long haul time, unless it's exposed to an external magnetic field to reinforce it, it will randomize.
Well, we said that at quantum level, the magnet is due to the charged particles called electrons, and they have a spin, and that they give them the angular momentum, and those magnetic moment is associated with it. So we have a magnetism. Then at atomic level, if we have a disalignment of the atoms with time in the lattice, then we lose the magnetism. Is that correct?
Well, except that I wouldn't really press on the term of angular momentum. It's not really what you and I think of as angular momentum. These are probably dimensionless point charges, so they can't really spin. They would violate all kinds of interesting laws. So, but a quantum mechanical aspect that's akin to what we think of angular momentum is taking place at, on the electrons level and producing a constant magnetic dipole moment in that electron. It just arranges itself randomly in nature unless exposed to an external magnetic field, and so the net magnetic dipole moment is negligible or non-existent, unless you force it into alignment in some manner.
I was trying to point at the cause of permanent magnet losing magnetism. So far we mentioned heat, mechanical damage, so we dropped the magnet. We may cause disalignment, changing the magnetic domain vector. We have a corrosion, and we have crystalline of the magnet that could be affected too, but when I was talking about misalignment of atoms in the lattice, I was talking about the crystalline of the magnet. And to actually...
Well, I I'm not quite sure what you're getting at. The lattice metal and things like metal, they exist as small grains of crystal fused to each other. They have an inherent magnetic dipole moment. If you disrupt the structure, you're disrupting the alignment of the magnetic dipole moments and affecting the strength of the magnet. So anything that can impact upon the orientation of the grains and the magnetic dipole moments of the grains will disrupt the magnet strength.
Let's go deeper into it. The energy needed for the ordering of magnetic dipoles in the unmagnetized material is taken from the potential energy of oriented dipoles. Demagnetizing them slowly will cause a transfer of that energy to other domains. But we think how long the it takes to demagnetize a permanent magnet, it depends on the process that is induced in the magnetization. Now, if we do reverse of it, we try to magnetize the magnet, the process will be exactly the same, but reverse. So we have some domains So in internal magnet, we have all domains that they are magnetized, and for some reason, there are some domains that they are not magnetized. Now, we could, the energy from nearby domains, let me drop, could be used to affect